Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to join us for a divine service of worship. We meet each Sunday at 10:30. We also meet Wednesday evenings at 7 o'clock for Vespers. If you live in the area, please do come pay us a visit. I also work with Wade Bellisbach. We work with the Saints up at St. Columba in East Kilbride, Scotland. They meet each Sunday morning at 11. We also have a mission in Edinburgh. We meet one Friday night a month. So if you live in the Glasgow or Edinburgh areas, please come and check us out. I know you'll receive a very warm welcome. If you don't live anywhere near those, then why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory, find the congregation that's closest to you, and as I say, go pay him a visit. I know you'll receive a very warm welcome, and we pray you'll be blessed by that. We'd also like to thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio, for without your prayers, without your gifts, we would not be able to continue this ministry, so we are deeply grateful to you for your support. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Matthew Vogan. Matthew is an author of a chapter in a book entitled Scotland's Debt to Martin Luther. It was published by the Scottish Reformation Society, for which Matthew is very involved. And the title of his chapter is The Gute and Godly Ballatus, Luther's Propaganda in Song. Matthew, welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here and talk about this subject today.
At the start of the chapter, it's quite catching. It's Lutheran propaganda in song. What do you mean by propaganda? We kind of think of that in negative terms, but is that how it's you have it viewed?
Yeah. So in terms of propaganda, I did put it in scare quotes because it might have negative connotations or ambivalent connotations, but I think what I was trying to get at there is that if you take off the negative connotations that we have of propaganda, literally it just means the spreading of ideas, and that's what we're looking at here: is how did Luther's ideas, if you like, or the Reformation teaching, how did that spread? How did it spread so widely? How did it spread so quickly? And in terms of propaganda, well, maybe there was a bit of an illicit aspect to that, if you like, a way in which the ideas were being spread in a almost secretive or certainly a way that was under the noses of the authorities. So those are some of the ideas I think that I had behind the use of that word, but I certainly meant it in a more positive sense than sometimes we use the word.
And you began your chapter talking about the printing press and how it was instrumental in the spreading of Luther's writings and the Reformation ideas. Could you tell us a little bit more about why that was such an important development?
Yeah, certainly. I think it's become a bit of a something that's been taken for granted and often been talked about. Well, you got the printing press and the Reformation, and hey presto, you know, that together brought about a birth of ideas and an unstoppable movement for change. But that wasn't inevitable, really. The printing press was there, but it hadn't really been used. And there's authors like Andrew Pettigrew and others who've brought this out. The ironic thing is that the main success story for the printing press at this time was indulgence certificates. That was something that was quick and easy to produce, and obviously were produced in their thousands. But books, not so much. You know, Gutenberg really sort of bankrupted himself by trying to print a Bible. And what they were trying to do was taking the old illustrated, illuminated book from the Middle Ages and trying to produce something as of such a high quality as the scribes had done in the Middle Ages. and not really harnessing the technology of the printing press in a way that was more economical and more mass produced. So the fact is that Luther wouldn't have really reached a wider audience if it hadn't been for the printing press. And the fact that he had this document, a page of the 95 theses, that they were translated into German and printed by others, not necessarily by himself, that meant that it really went like wildfire. It became viral for that reason. It couldn't really have done that before. I think if you go back to it and you think about it and you think, well, here's an academic document. It's for academic debate. It's originally written in Latin. It's posted up just for other scholars to see and to engage with. You're talking about Wittenberg, which is not the center of the Holy Roman Empire by any measure. It's actually a place that's a bit of a backwater academically and politically. So everything was stacked against the idea that this was going to be the place where a revolution of ideas would begin, but for the printing press and the fact that it was printed in that way. So within 5 years of 1517, Luther was Europe's most published author ever. And so he really harnessed the printing press. And the main thing that particularly drove that was printing sermons. So, for instance, short sermons like the Sermon on Indulgences and Grace in 1518, which was his explanation around the 95 Theses. This was reprinted 14 times in 1518 with print runs of maybe 1,000 copies each time. It was short. It was like a blog post, if you like, an 8-page pamphlet, 1,500 words. It could be read aloud in 10 minutes. You could take a sheet of paper and print it in a way that it was all printed on that piece of paper and then folded up and sold in large quantities. So it was just a dream for printers. Everyone wanted it, but it was cheap to produce and cheap to sell, and you could print it in a day or two rather than taking weeks or months to do, which a book would. So these pamphlets were critical to the success of the Reformation. They reckon that about 6 to 7 million, sorry, so that's between 6 and 7 million copies of pamphlets were printed in the first decade of the Reformation, and more than a quarter of those were written by Luther. So you can see that there was this cascade of an overwhelming tide of different publications and pamphlets that were putting out the Reformation message.
You mentioned this flood of materials that was being published to help spread this propaganda, if you will. But weren't most people in Germany and indeed throughout the Roman Empire, weren't they illiterate? So how did that work?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, literacy rates were very low in Europe and in Germany. Even they've been estimated about even 5%. And that would even be in the urban areas of people didn't have that access to ways in which to learn to read and to write. And so you think, well, how did all these pamphlets reach people? Well, it's because in part they were being read out aloud. So you don't have to be able to read to have access to it. We tend to think in our own terms of individual private reading, but things were social in those days. So while people worked in bakeries in areas like the Tyrol or maybe they're spinning in parts of Saxony, people were reading aloud these pamphlets. These days you walk into a factory or something like that and they've got the radio going, but they had something being read out for the workers while they were working away. So there was this then meant that whole guilds of artisans like leather workers or weavers, were very much in favor of the Reformation. And of course they had a particular power politically in the town councils and boroughs of different parts of Europe. And someone said that in 1523, better sermons could be heard in the inns of Ulm in Germany rather than in its churches. And of course, in other parts as well, in Basel and Switzerland in 1524, we're talking about people preaching from books and pamphlets in the town's taverns. So socially, these were being read out, and the word was going out in that way.
You then turn in the second section of your chapter to talk about Luther and his hymn writing. And that's an aspect of his life we often overlook, even Lutherans. So can you tell us how he got started? Why did he get started? Do you know the background for that?
Sure. Yeah. The very first time that he, you know, sort of wrote, as far as we know, poetically, certainly in the Reformation cause, was in response to a specific event. On the 1st of July, 1523, he receives this news from the Low Countries, that there was two Augustinian friars, young men from Antwerp, and they had been burnt at the stake in Brussels. And they were burnt at the stake because they were Lutherans and had embraced his teaching. And his response was that he sat down and wrote, first of all, a letter of consolation to Christians in the Low Countries and Netherlands. And then he wrote a song, and it was a popular song, like a popular folk song in a particular narrative style that people used in order to share news. And this was called Ein neues Lied, a new song. It was published in broadsheet in 1523. And he describes the martyrs, their faithfulness. He describes them as the true saints of God. And it's clear that he's, as it were, contrasting that with the medieval Roman Catholic idea of saints who are, you know, performing miracles and to be set up as above the people. But here were, if you like, ordinary Christians who had died. But there was a miraculous element, and it was this supernatural grace that was working in them to do wonders through them, through their own steadfastness, not through any outward miracles, but through, in a sort of spiritual, supernatural way. He deliberately used a medieval Roman Catholic Easter song, and even the pattern of the opening stanza borrowed from that, but specifically the melody as well. So he was using that. He was also using, as I say, a news ballad format, where you would share news as part of a song. So people wouldn't necessarily have newspapers, but it would be, the news would be shared in this way. Someone would stand up and they would sing out this contemporary events, and people would be up to date with the news in that way. So this was the style in which he used it. So he was using the popular culture, if you like, of the day, the folk culture, the way in which ideas were being spread and news was being spread, in order to highlight what had happened to these individual Lutherans.
And then he goes on to write much more what we would consider to be hymns or spiritual songs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's interesting when you think of that. I mean, I'm thinking in the Scottish context now as well, and thinking 1523. Well, in 1524 in Paris, there was a Frenchman who was burnt at the stake, but he was burnt at the stake for spreading Lutheran teaching in Scotland. And in one sense, he was the first martyr of the Scottish Reformation. So it's interesting the context, but just highlight that, as a point of interest. But yeah, he did move on to compose quite a lot of songs, specifically in this period, like in 1523 to 1524, he composed 24 songs, and those were two-thirds of all the songs that he wrote. Yeah, those were very economical to produce. They were very popular, like the 95 Theses. It was on a broadsheet or a broadside, something in German that was called a Flugbattern, which literally means a fly sheet. So you've got these single sheets of paper printed on one side, and they might have, if it was folded into four, you might have two or three songs written on them. So those were very popular. We've got instances of people selling them, and they're singing them as they're selling them. But these are very much based upon, Psalms, you know, so we've got, some that are based on Psalm 130, Psalm 67. Rather like, I suppose, the most famous of Luther's hymns is based on Psalm 46, Ein fester Burg, or a safe stronghold, our God is still. That was the nature of these. So it was, in a way, sort of giving people access to scripture, but also helping them internalize that, but mixing in with that the message of you know, the gospel together with that. And we have instances of people singing and selling them and being put in jail, but then them being so popular that they were clamoring for the release of the people that were put in prison. But yes, the earliest songbook appeared in Nuremberg in 1524. That was called the Achtliederbuch. It had eight songs. And then, there was also, hymn books, printed in Wittenberg, I think in 1524. There was a book of spiritual songs. And interesting from a Scottish point of view, there was a tune that was in that book in 1524 called Soldau, which continued to be sung to Psalm 6. Well, it still would be sung in Psalms, in churches where they sing Psalms, you know, but it was sung right through the centuries. So an interesting link with that first Lutheran book of spiritual songs.
And I suppose those links shouldn't really surprise us. I mean, I sort of have this idea that because of Luther, you know, being a friar, having to sing the Psalms each day, and again, many of these hymns were based on scripture, the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments. Do you think his early training in the theological schools and in the monastery, do you think that helped him with his songwriting?
Yes, I would think, you know, very much so. You know, I mean, as you'll know, I'm sure, you know, he was an accomplished musician, and he had a high view of music, and he did have a professional training in it. So obviously, you know, as a monk, he would be singing through the Psalms, or chanting them through in a month. So they would have been very much, sinking down into his, you know, consciousness, and he was able to make use of that. He would have made use of those melodies. But I think also, you know, we shouldn't neglect the sort of more popular side of things as well. While he was at the cathedral school in Magdeburg, there was an emphasis there upon the singing of vernacular German as well as Latin devotional songs. So there was that devotional song tradition as well as the plain chant of the Psalms. And then of course, there's famously, he was singing for his supper in the streets of Magdeburg, as a young scholar as well. So, he would know what would catch people's ears, what would open their purses, in terms of, that. So he was very much keyed into the popular element of that, music culture.
And you note how these songs really, you know, tended to bind the masses together. You talked about, you know, they would go to the prisons and demand the release of folks. So what was it that made the singing of these songs and these hymns such a great medium for the spreading the Reformation message at this time in history?
Yes, I think it gave them a sense of identity. I suppose, you know, to use maybe a slightly crude analogy, these days, you know, people in a popular context, they use song to bind themselves together, to give themselves common identity. So maybe in a protest march or in a football stadium, you know, the supporters, they'll bind themselves together with a sense of identity using songs. But I suppose it also gave them a kind of battle songs against the common enemy. So we talked about protest, you know, if you were protesting the release of certain individuals or showing a solidarity, then you could sing these together in crowds. I can think going slightly later in the Scottish Reformation into, say, the 1580s, you know, there was a release of a Scottish reformer, and people, everyone came joining together and they sang 24 going up, you know, the Royal Mile, crowds of people singing in four part harmony. You know, it was a way of really, articulating your strength of feeling and your solidarity with others. But there's also this tradition, from Erasmus on. Erasmus, you know, had this passage that, inspired William Tyndale to translate the scriptures. He wanted people, while they were at the plow while they were weaving, you know, to know something of this scripture, but to sing some portion of them, he says particularly. And so I think that was part of what Luther was envisaging, what other people were seeking to weave, as it were, the scriptures into the warp and woof of daily life, the working life of ordinary people. People were attracted to traditional folk songs that might tell the story of a hero, conquering, you know, some enemy or doing some exploit. And it was possible, as it were, to sort of do that with Luther as well. You know, there was a traditional folk song that was sung in honor of the Virgin Mary. And it was adapted, not a song written by Luther, but by an anonymous pamphlet. And they adapted that traditional song to talk about how God had sent Martin Luther as a great hero to save Christians, you know, from the Antichrist. So there was a way in which you can see how it's really connecting with, you know, some of the ways of thinking and responding that you would find amongst the common people.
And that's one of the things I found really interesting about your article, is you mentioned these songs and songbooks weren't really aimed at congregational singing. I mean, that's how we would think they would, you know, how they would be used. But as you've touched on, they're used in home settings, in school settings, even down at the tavern. Can you tell us, you know, about, you know, as I say, why they weren't used in church, and maybe the importance of singing them at home or at work?
I think we tend to just sort of think, well, if it's religious, then it's going to be sung at church. But we forget that song was just a universal medium at the time. You know, everyone made use of it, whether you were in the peasant's cottage or whether you were in the Duke's palace. After dinner, what did you do? You started to sing. Someone maybe started to sing something. You sang together. It was just a natural aspect of things. So it wasn't a private thing. It was a social thing. Popular song. You can just imagine that it was there when you walked down the streets, when you went to someone's house, every aspect of things. As we've talked about, when someone was working, they would be resorting to song. So it was just part of everything. And then it was free. You know, once you've memorized a song, you can recall it again. You know, it's catchy. The melody's catchy, so it can easily go viral. People are are interested in it. So that, I think that's how it particularly spread. But I think as well, there was this element of using songs at school, particularly. I think a lot of the songbooks were for school use, but also in a private devotional sense in the home. So it was, it had that that element of it where it wasn't just, they didn't have that sort of sacred secular divide, that public private divide that we have as part of our modern culture. But they had, and song just sort of transcended all the boundaries and brought people together.
Well, very interesting, but I'm also curious, how did Luther's enemies or opponents respond to all this song singing?
Well, it's interesting that some people who were, say, for instance, you know, the Roman Catholic side, they felt that, as for instance, 100 years later, a Jesuit named Adam Conson, he said Luther's songs had destroyed more songs than destroyed more souls than his writings and speeches. There was this sense that, you know, they really had spread. There was a more contemporary, a Romanist called Johann Leisentritt, and he talked about, he says, how these slanderous, abusive, and shameful little ditties have been spread everywhere in so few years, how they've become so familiar and very well known, how they've been come to be as many of them as there are people in these lands. It's not easy to say, nor for anyone who's not experienced it to believe or imagine. So it was like they were experiencing this onslaught of songs, and it felt more difficult to respond to. You could respond to books and you could answer them, and you could have this laborious pamphlet war, or you could have public debates, but very much more difficult to tackle and deal with this popular movement of song which they were experiencing.
Now, Matthew, could you tell us how our listeners, if they're interested, could get hold of a copy of this book, which is entitled Scotland's Debt to Martin Luther?
Certainly. If they go to the Scottish Reformation Society website, it's probably the easiest way. They may be able to get hold of it from other sources, but I'll give it, you know, they could order it through a bookshop, for instance. But I'll give you the Scottish Reformation Society website address. So that's www.scottishreformationsociety.org. So that would take people to the Scottish Reformation Society website, where they could access and request a copy of that.
Thank you for that. And we'd love to have you back next week as we carry on this conversation about particularly now we're talking about Luther's hymn writing, but we'll get to the Gute and Godly ballads next week if you will join us.
Thank you very much. Look forward to it.
And we invite our listeners to join us next week as well as we continue our conversation with Matthew Bogan.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.